Caution. This episode contains inappropriate language and references to drug use by foul-mouthed, pot-smoking hippies. If you're not ready to talk to your kids about hippies, please earmuff them for the entirety of this episode. December 29th, 1969. U.S. District Court for Northern Illinois, Chicago. Defense attorney Leonard Wineglass is examining his witness, Abby Hoffman. Now, directing your attention to approximately 6 a.m. the following morning, Wednesday, August 28th, do you recall what you were doing? I went to eat. I went with Paul Krasner, Beverly Baskinger, and Anita, and four police officers. Paul also had two Chicago police officers following him, as well as the two that were following me. We walked in the Ford, then would drive along behind us. Could you describe for the jury in the court what you were wearing at that time? Well, I had cowboy boots and brown pants and a shirt, and I had a gray felt ranger cowboy type hat down over my eyes like this. What, if anything, occurred while you were sitting there having breakfast? Well, two policemen came in and said, "We have orders to arrest you. You have something under your hat." So I asked them if they had a search warrant, and I said, "Did you check it out with Commander Brash?" Me and him got an agreement, and they went to check it out with them while we were eating breakfast. After a period of time, did they come back? They came back with more police officers. There were about four or five patrol cars surrounding the restaurant. The Red Squad cops who had been following us came in the restaurant, four or five police, and they said, "We checked. Now will you take off your hat?" They were stern, more serious about it. "What did you do?" "Well, I lifted up the hat and I went bang, bang." They grabbed me by the jacket and pulled me across the bacon and eggs and Anita over the table. Threw me on the floor and out the door and threw me against the car and they handcuffed me. I was just eating the bacon and going oink, oink. "Did they tell you why you were being arrested?" "They said they arrested me because I had the word fuck on my forehead. I'd put it on with this magic marker before we left the house. They called it an obscenity. I put it on for a couple of reasons. One was that I was tired of seeing my picture in the paper and having newsmen come around. And I know if you got that word on your forehead, they ain't gonna print your picture in the paper. Secondly, sort of summed up my attitude about the whole thing, what was going on in Chicago. I like that four-letter word. I thought it was kind of holy, actually." Hello, and welcome to Daring Dissent, where we uplift stories of remarkable resistance throughout history. I'm your host, historian and teacher Jeff DeMoss, and I am excited about today's episode. We're going to focus on Youth International Party founder Abby Hoffman, the Yippies. Abby's going to use political theater and stunts to combat the Vietnam War, capitalist greed, and racism. We'll focus most heavily on the trial of the Chicago 8 and the brilliant, bizarre words that come out of the mouth of this counterculture icon. Let's do it. Abbott Hoffman was born in Worcester, Massachusetts in November of 1936. He described his middle-class Jewish upbringing as idyllic. In his childhood, you know, he ran into some trouble. He developed a reputation for fighting, disrespecting teachers, and vandalism. The rebellion starts early with this one. In 10th grade, he's going to get kicked out of classical high school. He's going to write an essay in his English class on atheism where he says, quote, "God could not possibly exist, for if he did, there wouldn't be any suffering in the world." His English teacher ripped it up and called him a communist punk, so he attacked him. As he's finishing his high school career at a private school, Worcester Academy, he's going to be arrested at 17 for driving without a license. But he's a pretty good student. He's going to graduate in 1959 from Brandeis University with a degree in psychology. He's actually going to study under Abraham Maslow of Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs and very famous Marxist theoretician Herbert Marcuse. He's going to be a pretty impressive college tennis player at Brandeis. He's going to go on to get his master's from UC Berkeley in psychology. And this is where he gets his first taste of activist politics. After he gets his master's, he's going to spend some of his time being just like a traveling pharmaceutical salesman in 1963. He's still, you know, doing a little bit of activism, but where things really change for him is when he moves to New York City's East Village, which was a hippie hub in the early 1960s. He's going to work at Liberty House, which was this store that sold products made by black women in Mississippi who couldn't find a market in their hometowns in the Jim Crow South. He's going to get involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. So we're going to see right away in his early political activism, he's going to establish himself pretty firmly as an anti-racist. Hoffman's real political journey starts when he's going to meet Jerry Rubin and Stu Albert. And in 1967, the three of them are going to come together to form the Youth International Party, better known as the Yippies. And their goal is to politicize the hippies, bringing social change and gain huge media attention. So they're this anarchist guerrilla theater group formed to tout their revolutionary, psychedelic ideas. If you Google a picture of what the Yippie flag looks like, it's a red star on a black background with a big marijuana leaf over it. And their whole MO is that they're going to use humor and ridiculous antics to spread their revolutionary message of being against the Vietnam War, against the establishment, against racism, and they're very clearly socialist. Hoffman once noted, "I said that fun was very important too, that it was a direct rebuttal of the kind of ethics and morals that were being put forth in the country to keep people working in a rat race, which didn't make any sense. Because in a few years, that machines would do all the work anyway. That there was a whole system of values that people were taught to postpone their pleasure, to put all their money in the bank, to buy life insurance, a whole bunch of things that didn't make any sense to our generation at all. And that fun actually was becoming quite subversive." A year after its founding, Hoffman would write A Revolution Toward a Free Society by A. Yippie, which are 18 demands that he wrote during the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. 1. An immediate end to the war in Vietnam and the withdrawal of all foreign-based troops and the abolition of military draft. 2. An immediate freedom for Huey Newton and the Black Panthers and all other black people. 3. The legalization of marijuana and all other psychedelic drugs. 4. A prison system based on the concept of rehabilitation rather than punishment. The total disarmament of all the people, beginning with the police. The abolition of money. The abolition of pay housing, pay media, pay transportation, pay food, pay education, pay clothing, pay medical health, and pay toilets. A society which works towards and actively promotes the concept of full unemployment. A program of ecological development that would provide incentives for the decentralization of crowded cities and encourage rural living. Free birth control and abortions. An educational system which breaks down its barriers between school and community. An end to all censorship. We're sick of a society that has no hesitation about showing people committing violence and refuses to show a couple fucking. We believe that people should fuck all the time, anytime, wherever they wish. This is not a program demand, but a simple recognition of the reality around us. We want a political system which is more streamlined and responsive to the needs of all the people, regardless of age, sex, or race. Perhaps a national referendum system conducted via television or a telephone voting system. We want a program that encourages and promotes the arts. And then 18 was just left blank for anybody to fill in what they wanted. One of the founding members of the Yippies said, "We'd come to share an awareness that there was a linear connection between putting kids in prison for smoking pot in this country and burning them to death with napalm on the other side of the planet." Let's hear Abby describe his own philosophy.
"It's a revolution primarily first in consciousness. War will be won in terms of head counts, not body counts. And we have to convince a majority of people that there's another way of life, that there's a possibility of founding a nation dedicated to human values rather than property values. I think that's the one thing that the eight of us have in common, that we reject capitalism as a form of human relationship."
"Are you a communist?"
"Well, if you would define it, I would not be ashamed to be one. I'm not quite sure what it is."
Are you a Marxist or a Marxist-Leninist?
"Marxist, Karpo-Marxist, and John Leninist, yeah." "Sure, I mean, I don't know, I don't read.
Listen,
all I would do is watch TV commercials, I don't read, so I don't know, I guess I'm a Marxist, why not?"
I just want to tell you right away, when you hear me reading stuff from Abby, you're not going to get to hear that fantastic accent, so just imagine the entire time that I'm doing that excellent Massachusetts accent. So let's clear something up. Are hippies and yippies the same thing? No. Hoffman was much more committed to attempting to impact actual political change rather than purely symbolic action. Although he embraced many of the same ideals and culture of the hippie movement, he was often critical of hippies who did nothing but smoke pot and meditate. He wanted to smoke pot, meditate, and then tear down the entire establishment. In his own words, he said, "Personally, I always held my flower in a clenched fist." Let's dive into Abbey's first famous foray into guerrilla theater. It's August 24th, 1967, and he and gay rights activist Jim Ferrat plan this idea to protest capitalist greed in America through a demonstration at the New York Stock Exchange. Jerry Rubin, Stu Albert are there too. Marty Jazeer, who published Wind Magazine, which was this publication of the War Resisters League, was there. And he said, "I saw Abbey's idea as simply a funny Marxist zap to expose the greed of capitalism. Because I associated Marxism with conspiratorial politics and assumed we would have to look respectable to get into the stock exchange, I got a haircut, put on a suit and tie." Hoffman and the others are dressed in full-on hippie regalia. So the guards call them out when they try to, you know, infiltrate the stock exchange, and the guard says they don't allow demonstrations. Hoffman replies, "Oh, we're Jewish, not demonstrators." So the guard is uncomfortable and clearly confused, but the prospect of being labeled anti-Semitic kind of freaks him out and allows them to go in. So there's varied reports on exactly what happened next, but they went above the trading floor and they threw a bunch of money down. Confusion was replaced by a scramble to grab the money, flee really quickly, and reporters are waiting outside. When the reporters ask who they are, Abbey says he's Cardinal Spellman. And when they ask how many of them are there, he said, "We don't even exist." And then he burns a $5 bill while they record. One biographer noted, "Abbey believed it was more important to burn money than draft cards. To burn a draft card meant one refused to participate in the war. To burn money meant one refused to participate in society." Abbey described it this way: "Showering money on the Wall Street brokers was the TV age version of driving the money changers from the temple. Was it a real threat to the empire? Well, 2 weeks after our band of mine terrorists raided the stock exchange, $20,000 was spent to enclose the gallery with bulletproof glass." So Abbey gets real famous off this stunt. Let's rewind back to January 1967. Jerry Rubin, Abbey Hoffman, Timothy Leary, very famous advocate of LSD, and poet Allen Ginsberg are sitting around with a bunch of other hippie types in San Francisco. They're drinking wine and celebrating the day's human being, the first major gathering of all the different counterculture forces of the 1960s. And then the acid kicks in. They come up with the March on the Pentagon to end the Vietnam War. Rubin and Hoffman were focused on finding ways to mobilize the hippie movement into more direct political action. There was already this very peace and love kind of protest that was planned, and they decided to turn it into this much more serious march. So Hoffman's describing this combo he had with Rubin. "I said that the Pentagon was a five-sided evil symbol in most religions, and that it might be possible to approach this from a religious point of view. If we got large numbers of people to surround the Pentagon, we could exorcise it of its evil spirits." So the plan for the exorcism was to perform a ritual to lift the Pentagon off the ground and turn it, quote, "orange and vibrate until all evil emissions had fled." And then the Vietnam War would come to an immediate end. Yes, every one of these planners was constantly on acid. No, they did not believe this was 100% real. They understand the significance of the symbolism. But here's my favorite part of this. One guy shows up to the planning meeting and is like, "No, let's really do this." One account from the planners was like, "And all of us supposed radicals look like a bunch of moderates next to the guy who actually plans to levitate this building. So, I don't know, let's just do it." So on October 21st, 1967, you're going to see a bunch of people gather at the Lincoln Memorial for anti-war speeches from people like Baby Doctor, Benjamin Spock. Man, the 60s just had a lot of random people coming together. Awesome stuff. They're going to march across the bridge to Virginia. Norman Mailer described, "The smell of marijuana, sweetest leaves of burning tea, floated down to the mall, where its sharp bite of sugar and smoldering grass pinched the nose, relaxed the neck." So they assemble at the Pentagon in front of a bunch of military police and federal marshals. So here's the formal invocation that they put on a leaflet that they gave to everybody who came to the protest. Here's what the exorcism was supposed to be. "We, freemen, of all colors of the spectrum, in the name of God, Ra, Jehovah, Anubis, Osiris, Tlaloc, Quetzalcoatl, Thoth, Psath, Hala, Krishna, Chango, Chimiki, Chukwu, Olisa, Bulu, Uwa, Umales, Urasasu, Oduat..." You get the point, okay? Jesus is in there, Buddha, Rama, sure. do exercise and cast out the evil which has walled and captured the pentacle of power and perverted its use to the need of the total machine and its child, the hydrogen bomb, and has suffered the people of the planet Earth. The American people and creatures of the mountains, woods, streams, and oceans, grievous mental and physical torture, and the constant torment of the imminent threat of utter destruction. So this was supposed to be what was going to start the exorcism. I guess they were supposed to say it together. I couldn't even make my way all the way through it. Instead, what happens is a bunch of simultaneous rituals get performed. Because, surprise, it's tough to get a bunch of hippies to get on the same page. So, for example, Ed Sanders of the rock band The Fugs yelled out a sexually suggestive invocation with lots of calls out of, "Out, demons, out!" Poet Allen Ginsberg, if you know anything about him, he's just going to perform some Tibetan mantras and, in general, be kind of a weird dude. Abby, meanwhile, is working hard pairing up couples to perform PDA to envelop the Pentagon with communal love. And all the while, some Mayan healers are sprinkling cornmeal in circles of power. Good stuff. Good stuff. Hey, you know that iconic picture you've seen of a hippie putting a carnation in the barrel of a soldier's gun? That's from this event. They had 200 pounds of flowers brought in. Here's Abby describing what happens next. We got arrested. It's illegal to measure the Pentagon. Didn't know it up to that point. When we were arrested, they asked us what we were doing. We said it was to measure the Pentagon, and we wanted a permit to raise it 300 feet in the air. And they said, how about 10? So we said, okay. And they threw us out of the Pentagon, and we went back to New York and had a press conference, told them what it was about. We also introduced a drug called Lace, which when you squirted it, the policemen made them take their clothes off and make love, a very potent drug. You're going to have to keep up here. Fact, fiction, reality, ridiculous. They're all combined, they're all intertwined, they're sometimes one and the same to Abby. So just in case you needed me to make this clear, they did not manage to lift the Pentagon off the ground. But it was a big media sensation. Here's what Ginsberg had to say about it. The levitation of the Pentagon was a happening that demystified the authority of the military. The Pentagon was symbolically levitated in people's minds in the sense that it lost its authority, which had been unquestioned and unchallenged until then. But once that notion was circulated in the air, and once the kid put his flower in the barrel, the kid looking just like himself but tense and nervous, the authority of the Pentagon psychologically was dissolved. All right, let's take it to the main event. It's August 1968, Chicago, Democratic National Convention. Let's get some context first. The Vietnam War is ramping up. There's 1,000 U.S. soldiers killed every month at this point. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were killed just months earlier. LBJ is not seeking a second term. And Bobby Kennedy was killed, so Hubert Humphrey, who's the mainstream candidate, is facing Eugene McCarthy, this more left-wing candidate who doesn't have a real shot at the Democratic nomination. The varying movements that make up the new left have some plans separately to hold some protests at this major Democratic convention over the state of the Democratic Party, the war, and the country as a whole. The Yippie plan for the convention is called the Festival of Life. Here's the official Yippie call out for the festival. Join us in Chicago in August for an international festival of youth, music, and theater. Rise up and abandon the creeping meatball. Come all you rebels, youth spirits, rock minstrels, truth seekers, peacock freaks, poets, barricade jumpers, dancers, lovers, and artists. We are making love in the parks. We are reading, singing, laughing, printing newspapers, groping, and making a mock convention, and celebrating the birth of free America in our own time. Everything will be free. Bring blankets, tents, draft cards, body paint, Mr. Leary's cow, food to share, music, eager skin, and happiness. The threats of LBJ, Mayor Daley, and J. Edgar Frico will not stop us. We are coming. We are coming from all over the world. The life of the American spirit is being torn asunder by the forces of violence, decay, and the napalm cancer fiend. We demand the politics of ecstasy. We are the delicate spores of the new fierceness that will change America. We will create our own reality. We are free America. And we will not accept the false theater of the death convention. The Yippies know how to put on a show and to use spectacle to make a political point. That's the plan in Chicago. But the Yippies, along with groups like the Students for Democratic Societies and other New Left groups as a whole, try to apply for permits to peacefully protest near the convention, and they're all denied. Hoffman is going to jokingly ask the permit clerk for $100,000 to call off the protests.
A what?
$100,000 ransom.
I don't understand a ransom. You mean to rip off this city for $100,000?
Yeah.
It's a groovy thing to do. What, are you kidding? What are they going to do with it anyway?
Would you have done it?
What?
Would you have taken $100,000 to call everything off?
I would have taken $100,000 as to calling it off. Well.
Well, how much is it worth to you to call it off?
Call off
a
what?
A million? Would you have done it for a million?
Revolution?
Yeah. What's your price?
My life.
So there's a lot that goes on in these 5 days of protests in Chicago. The Yippies are going to nominate a pig for president. His name is Pigasus the Immortal. The pig is confiscated. Jerry Rubin and Phil Ox are arrested. The pig is running through the streets at one point. That's a weird story. Here's Abby at the later trial describing a class on snake dancing that took place in the park during the protests. People would have a pole and there'd be about six people and then about six people behind them, holding them around the waist. Four or five lines of these people with men, women, and kids, maybe 8 years old on this whole thing. And people would bounce from one foot to the other and yell, "Washoi, washoi," which is kind of Japanese for yippie, I guess. And they would just march up and down the park like this, mostly laughing and giggling, because the newsmen were taking this quite seriously. Then at a certain point, everybody would turn in and sort of just collapse and fall on the ground and laugh. I believe we lost about four or five yippies during that great training. The exciting part was when the police arrested two army intelligence officers in the trees. Alright, so here's what happens that makes this one of the most famous moments of the 1960s. So thousands of people had come for these 5 days of protests, and things were tense with small pockets of violence in the days leading up to this big event. The whole world is watching is the most popular refrain from these protests. What's going to happen is that police are going to try to impose an 11 p.m. curfew and restrict the ability for protests to happen at all. In Chicago, you've got 12,000 Chicago police officers, 5,600 members of the Illinois National Guard, and 5,000 U.S. Army soldiers, and they are equipped and trained with tear gas and batons. It's August 28th, 1968. This is the day that everything goes down. Abby wakes up that morning, has breakfast, has a little run-in with the cops. We talked about that in the intro to the show. This is the only day that a permit was going to be granted for a lawful protest. So in the afternoon, 15,000 people show up in Grant Park. Police form a barricade around them to prevent them from marching to the convention. Thousands of protesters are going to attempt to march to the International Amphitheater where the convention is being held. Here's an interview with Hoffman earlier that day.
Those yippies that march on the amphitheater or go downtown or sit in restaurants or demand their rights, they'll be risking their life. That's right. These cops here are tough. They'd kill you with a smile. Shoot to kill daily, you know. And it's difficult. I mean, some people want to go this way, some people want to go this way, and they say that those people are interfering with their thing, but somehow it works out. I mean, everybody is allowed to do their thing. If some people storm the amphitheater, they storm the amphitheater. Some people want to swim naked in the lake, they swim naked in the lake. Other people want to smoke dope. Other people want to go and tell the cops what we're doing. That's good. The cops want to come down and beat our heads. That's it. I mean, it's all conceived as a total theater, with everyone becoming an actor. The Democrats, Mr. Humphrey, whatever his name is, the other candidates, I don't even know their names.
In his book Battleground Chicago, author Frank Cush is going to describe the actions of law enforcement there when the protesters go to march towards the convention. They started pulling off one person at a time, spraying mace in their eyes, striking their ribs or kidneys with clubs, and tripping them. Their eyes were bulging with hate, and they were screaming with a sound that I've never heard from a human being. They planned to give what they thought of as a spoiled generation a good ripping, a good beating, and they did. The next day, on August 29th, as Humphrey is accepting the nomination, more protesters try to march to the convention and are met again by police with tear gas and batons. I'm just telling you pieces of the story here. By the end here, Chicago police had a total of 589 people were arrested, 119 police officers, and 100 protesters were injured. A human rights medical committee said later that it was more than 1,000 people, including protesters and members of the press, who were injured and treated during these protests. The trial of the Chicago 8, here we are. It's September 1969, and we're going to have eight protest leaders that were at the Democratic National Convention get tried for conspiracy to cross state lines with the intent to incite a riot at that convention. These are the first charges ever filed under these anti-riot provisions of Title 10 of the Civil Rights Act of 68, which made it a federal crime to cross state lines supposedly to incite a riot or conspire to do so. It's known as the H-Rap Brown Law. And this was designed by racist Southern lawmakers trying to combat civil rights demonstrations. So the charges that are brought against these eight are for a broader conspiracy, like they are going to be working together to plan this out.
I think we're being tried with carrying a state of mind across the state border. And it's a very unusual law. We're the first ones to be tried under it. We're doing quite well. I think we win every single day but the last. If it wasn't for the law, we'd win hands down, because you've seen their case. It's all never land of insanity that only the U.S. government and city of Chicago can dwell in. I mean, we're saying that we're not ashamed of anything that we did in Chicago. We're not ashamed of the way we conduct our lives in between the Chicagos that hit the headlines, that what we're about is an alternative way of living. And we believe in that way of life. And if the government wants to call it a conspiracy, well, right on. Conspiracy means to breathe together. And it seems like a groovy thing. I mean, you meet some nice people in a conspiracy. All people are like coming from all over the country to like visit us. Courthouse. They send us mail to the conspiracy, care of the federal building, Chicago, Illinois.
Setting is it's September 1969. We're at the U.S. District Court for Northern Illinois at the Dirksen Federal Building, designed by famed architect Mies van der Rohe. One sympathetic student protester who was in the gallery during the trial described the courtroom as having the bullying sterility of architecture that could have been appreciated only by Mussolini. So these eight defendants are facing five-year max sentences. They're let out on bail, but the trial's going to last 5 months. One of my favorite facts about this supposed conspiracy case is that the defendants mostly need to be introduced to each other during pre-trial prep. One of the defendants, Bobby Seale, is going to ask another Dave Dellinger for his card, thinking that he was one of the lawyers as they're doing pretrial prep. And their lawyer's going to ask Abby under oath if he came to the city of Chicago for the purpose of encouraging and promoting violence during the convention week. And Abby just responded with, "We couldn't even agree on lunch." So this thing isn't a conspiracy. We know that from the beginning. We'll talk a little bit more about what actually happened at the convention as we go through the trial too. So these eight leaders were chosen because they represented different pieces of the new left, and the brand new Nixon Justice Department wanted to make examples out of them. So LBJ's on his way out the door. Nixon wins the presidency against Humphrey. And LBJ's Justice Department refused to indict anyone for what happened at the convention when they did a full investigation of it. But Nixon's new Attorney General, John Mitchell, is going to change course. And part of the Justice Department's overall strategy under Nixon is to get these protesters off the streets and into the courtroom where they're alone and thinking about their own safety, having to worry about legal fees. You know, the FBI file on Abby Hoffman was 13,262 pages long. If you know anything about the Nixon administration, Nixon freaking hated hippies. He hated the left as a whole, and he's going to have this radical crusade that in many unethical ways is going to try to tear down this especially new left. So I want to be crystal clear about something before we get into the actual trial. An official investigation, which took months and was combing over thousands and thousands of files, conducted thousands of interviews, determined in December of 68 that what happened in Chicago was a, quote, police riot. This report acknowledged that there were instances of obscenities at police, rocks, sticks, bathroom tiles, and human feces that were thrown at cops. Some of this is planned, some spontaneous, some provoked by the police. And the official report says, the nature of the response was unrestrained and indiscriminate violence on many occasions. That violence was made all the more shocking by the fact that it was often inflicted upon persons who had broken no law, disobeyed no order, and made no threat. Newsmen and photographers were singled out for assault and their equipment deliberately damaged. Fundamental police training was ignored, and officers when on the scene were often unable to control their men. One officer said, "What happened didn't have anything to do with police work." So the official government investigation into this is going to make it crystal clear that this was a police riot. Yes, there were things that were clashes between the police and the protesters, and certainly there were protesters who did something wrong, but it was a disproportionate response. That's why LBJ's Justice Department and the Attorney General Ramsey Clark chose not to have any indictments against any of these protesters or protest leaders for some broader conspiracy. So this is certainly a conspiracy from Nixon to go after and make an example out of these people. And there's going to be members of the Chicago 8 who recognize that this is a political trial right from the beginning. Abbey describes it as, he says, "It's going to be a combination Scopes trial, revolution in the streets, Woodstock Festival, and People's Park all rolled into one."
The trial is absolute poetry. It's the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. It's really good. Was it for the law, we'd win easy.
But how do you think the trial will affect, you know, like what's going to happen in the
it's going to get, it'll get a lot of people in the establishment headaches. They'll cry a lot. Well, because their world is like falling apart, and the world that they suppose that they like learned about in the third grade and they think is existent in this country, it's this trial just like rips a mask off that. It's just, like, that's ridiculous. So you have we have essentially an action the same as we had in Chicago last year. No, there was in the streets, now it's in the courts, but it's an action that's going to divide the ruling class.
You think the ruling class is beginning to...
Well, I mean, Life magazine called it an act of vengeance, you know, not a trial. Time magazine has already said we're being railroaded. I mean, when you get the mass media like that, dividing up and splitting, you know, along the different issues, and then you, like, sort of move in and you say, look, you know, what we really need is a revolution. We really got to overthrow the country. See, we want money, we want guns, we want dynamite, lollipops, acid, dope, everything.
So let's meet some of the people we're going to be hearing from in this trial. Let's start first with Judge Julius Hoffman, the 73-year-old judge that was presiding, and whoo boy, does he have it out for these defendants. Tom Hayden, who's one of the defendants, described him as very old, and his condition was known to the Chicago defense community as either senile or totalitarian. But in the culture of the federal courts, it meant you never crossed him. You just said, yes, sir. On the prosecution side, we've got Richard Schultz and Tom Foran are the main prosecuting attorneys, and Richard Schultz is this young kind of bulldog in the Justice Department who was chosen for his ability to be tough and fierce against these protesters. Abby's going to originally call up a lawyer by the name of Gerald Lefcourt to represent him, and Lefcourt tells this great story where Abby calls him up and says, quote, "I have a dentist and a doctor, but because I have three criminal cases, I really need a lawyer." What's crazy is that Lefcourt and the entire legal team for the defense is actually jailed for contempt before the trial because Judge Hoffman, which is confusing, Hoffman has the same last name, so I'll refer to him as Judge Hoffman. It's going to play a role in the trial. Judge Hoffman's going to try to force Lefcourt to represent Bobby Seale, one of the leaders of the Black Panthers, and they say, no, we're not his lawyer. That's not how this works. We don't have to represent everyone. And Judge Hoffman is showing right from the beginning that he's not having any of this, and he's out for the defense team and holds them in contempt. It winds up getting dismissed and very heavily criticized by the legal community because it makes no sense why they got held in contempt. So Lefcourt and the legal team winds up leaving. Lefcourt actually decides to go focus on the trial of the Panther 21 case in New York, where 21 Black Panthers were charged with conspiracy to kill police and bomb buildings, and he winds up getting them acquitted on all 156 charges because they were very trumped up charges. So enter into the defense team William Kunstler, who's going to take over as lead defense attorney. Kunstler is going to wear a black armband the entire time during the trial to commemorate the Vietnam War dead. And he's going to work together with Leonard Weinglass, who does a lot of the questioning of Abby, as we'll learn. So let's meet the Chicago Eight. First, we've got Abby and Jerry Rubin, who are going to be charged as leaders of the Yippie movement and the protests that they had going on with the Festival of Life. Then we have the elder statesman of the Chicago Eight, who's Dave Dellinger, who's 54 at the time of the trial. His story's pretty awesome. He was imprisoned as a conscientious objector to World War II, and he's a very prominent civil rights activist. Then the person who goes from making this the Chicago Eight to the Chicago Seven is Black Panther co-founder Bobby Seale, who was barely at the convention. And what winds up happening with Bobby Seale is his lawyer is going to have surgery right before the trial. So Seale does the trial without a lawyer because Judge Hoffman denies motion to delay the trial. What's going to happen is Seale's going to constantly address Judge Hoffman and try to defend his right to a lawyer. One point he says, "You have George Washington and Benjamin Franklin sitting in a picture behind you, and they were slave owners. You're acting in the same manner, denying me my constitutional rights." And in a very famous moment in the trial, Judge Hoffman is going to bound and gag Bobby Seale in the courtroom. Bobby Seale is the only black defendant among the Chicago Eight and the one that makes the least sense to have been there. He was barely at the convention. He hasn't met most of the people that are at the trial. And it's this shocking moment in the courtroom where you've got a black man that's going to be bound and gagged while everyone else who's been having their own outburst doesn't have the same thing happen. And so his trial winds up actually being declared a mistrial, and he's severed from the trial of everybody else. He winds up never being convicted. He does get sentenced to 4 years in prison for 16 counts of contempt and winds up serving three of those years. But this is what's going to make it go from the trial of the Chicago 8 to the trial of Chicago 7. The other important defendants are Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis, who are leaders of Students for a Democratic Society. And then there's two leftist activists, Lee Weiner and John Freunds, who were not nearly as prominent as the others. And there's some pretty strong evidence that they were tossed in there as defendants to try to make this seem more like a legitimate trial because they just weren't as active at the convention as the other five. One Berkeley student activist described his admiration for the defendants when he said, "Whoever you were, you could see a reflection of yourself in one or another of the defendants. The defendants appeared to be a more pronounced, edgier, more daring version of oneself. It wasn't only they who were on trial. It felt as if our whole generation had been indicted. So this whole thing is going to be a massive media circus in a really, really, really important moment in the 1960s where you kind of see the entire culture wars that are going on in the 60s are going to be put on trial for everyone to see in this political show trial." I mean, just reading a list of the defense character witnesses is wild. Norman Mailer, Timothy Leary, Jesse Jackson, Arlo Guthrie, Woody's son, Allen Ginsberg, Phil Ox, Country Joe McDonald are going to be some of the defense character witnesses that get called to the stand. So in an interesting side note, Woodstock 1969 is going to be announced to be happening in August while the trial is scheduled for September, and Abby is pissed that the promoters of Woodstock are going to make money off young people while our movement is on trial for our lives, as he says. And he goes and talks to the promoters and he says, "We're going to protest the concert unless you put performers on the program who are anti-war." So they just gave Abby 10 grand to book whoever he wanted, and he picked Phil Ox and Country Joe, among others, who are these anti-war radical musicians. And Abby, unsurprisingly, had a great time at Woodstock. He said it was a phenomenal burst of human energy and spirit that came and went like a tidal wave up there in White Lake, Bethel, Woodstock, Aquarian Exposition, Music Festival, Happening, Monster, or whatever you called the fucking thing. I took a trip to our future. At one point, he's super high on LSD at Woodstock, and he interrupts The Who to protest his fellow activists' arrest and incarceration. Obviously pisses off a lot of people. It's kind of a recurring theme. I found lots of stories that I didn't put into the podcast of Abby just being super high on LSD and, you know, getting punched in the face because he makes some people angry. So this trial is clearly going to be a circus.
But to the image of the court, you see, to the image of the court's dignity and decorum, as the judge refers to it, were tremendously disruptive. I mean, all of us have some concept of the media. You know, I do a somersault, I do a handstand downstairs on the sidewalk, you know, in front of the court building on the day it opens, you see, that by the time that hits the East Coast or the West Coast, that was done in the middle of the courtroom in front of the judge, you see. And then the judge reads out in the paper the next day and say, "I will not have my courtroom turned into a circus." But you see, nothing's happening in the room. But mythically, everything is going on in the room. I think people around the country have a view of this trial as one of total chaos, defendants fighting with marshals on the floor, people coming in naked, the judge jerking off in his chair, you know, witnesses standing up and screaming bloody murder, people running around with guns and bombs.
So reading the trial transcript brought me a lot of joy and anger as I prep for this episode. There's so many great moments to share with you, but I'm going to focus on the role that Abby played in the trial. Let's talk first about his many stunts and outbursts, many of which get him one of his 24 counts of contempt. Prosecuting attorney Richard Schultz's opening statement mentions Hoffman. He blows the jury a kiss. The judge says, "The jury is directed to disregard the kiss from Mr. Hoffman." The jury eventually is going to get sequestered in this trial for largely BS reasons, which means that they can't see the news. Abby shows up the next day and he holds up a newspaper for them to see. And when obviously called out on this, he said, "It ain't a newspaper. It's the Berkeley Tribe and doesn't tell lies. So it isn't a newspaper." He's going to mess a lot with Judge Hoffman. He's going to call him his illegitimate father. He's going to nickname him Julie for Julius throughout the trial. He's going to refuse to stand most times when the judge enters. When Bobby Seale is restrained and gagged, Abby says, "You may as well kill him if you're going to gag him. It seems that way, doesn't it?" The judge says, "You're not permitted to address the court, Mr. Hoffman. You have a lawyer." "This isn't a court. This is a neon oven." While being chastised on the stand by the judge, he just tells the jury to wait until you see the movie. At one point, they put a Vietnamese flag on their table. Him and Jerry Rubin are just messing around a lot during this trial. At one point, Abby says, "You know you cannot win the fucking case. The only way you can is to put us away for contempt. We have contempt for this court and for you, Schultz, and for this whole rotten system. That's the only justice. That is why they want this, because they can't prove this case." So at the end of the day, he recognizes this as a political trial, and so he's going to treat it like the joke that it is. And he's going to go back and forth between very legitimate critiques of the justice system and then just making a mockery of the whole thing. Let's listen to his lawyer, Leonard Wineglass, and the courtroom sketch artist tell of one particular antic.
One of the key witnesses against us was a Chicago police officer named Frappolet. And as he's testifying and he's naming names and he's attributing acts of violence, words of violence to various defendants, it was all being taken down by the media that was present. Abby turned to me and he said, "Is this witness hurting us?" And I said, "Yeah, I think this testimony could hurt us." And he said, "Well, I'll make it disappear."
He said, "You know, have you drawn me yet?" And I said, "Well, yes." He said, "Well, I don't think you've drawn me enough." So I said, "Well," at that point, he stood on the table, on his head on the table. And the courtroom was filling up with people. And he said, "Did you get it?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "I promise you."
And that night we're watching television. And what was broadcast on the television was his headstand. And Abby kind of nudged me in the ribs and said, "You see, Frappolet disappeared."
One time when the judge is trying to clarify a statement that Mr. Hoffman made, he says he doesn't use that last name anymore. He goes, "Just Abby. I don't have a last name, Judge. I lost it. We can't respect the law when it's tyranny." The biggest thing that he gets contempt for is just laughing at the rulings of the court. Judge Hoffman just overrules every single thing that the defense attorneys object to. Apparently, there's a couple different times where the defense attorneys just stand up to object, and before they could even speak, the judge says overruled. So this trial is an absolute mockery of justice. There's multiple times where Judge Hoffman is confused about who laughed after Abby does, and he tries to get the court to cite another defendant, and Abby always clarifies that it was he who laughed. He's going to constantly refer to Richard Schultz, the prosecuting attorney, as Dick. As the judge is admonishing the defense counsel for having a press conference, Abby yells out that the judge gave an interview to Time Magazine. So we're just seeing all these different examples where he's able to point out the ridiculousness of what's happening in the courtroom. At another point, the judge makes a comment about his experience practicing law in the Southern District of New York, and Abby says, "When it was under British control." So the judge is not a fan of what Abby was doing. His most famous antic was when he and Rubin show up to court one morning wearing judge's robes. He's going to take them off, rub his feet on them, and then he's wearing a cop uniform underneath. When asked about this later in the trial, he says, "I wiped my feet on the robes because I didn't see a black robe of justice. I saw a white robe with a hood on it." At another point, he wears a Revolutionary War uniform to the trial. And remember, he's showing up to the trial every day with press outside before and after. And so these things are getting broadcast on news for 5 months, and he's able to have this massive soapbox to have not just their message be heard about the war or about the system as a whole, it's for them to also target the ridiculousness of the criminal justice system and Nixon's attempts to try to target the left. There's one instance where a witness is trying to describe how hippies dress, and the judge says, "Let the record show that Mr. Hoffman stood up, lifted his shirt up, and bared his body in the presence of the jury." His lawyer says, "Your Honor, that is Mr. Hoffman's way." The judge goes dancing around, and there was laughter in the courtroom, and counselor says, "Your Honor, that is Mr. Hoffman's way." Judge says, "It is a bad way." When the judge calls him out one time for not respecting the dignity and decorum of the court, he says, "But when the decorum is oppression, the only dignity that free men have is the right to speak out. Furthermore, you said we do not honor your authority, but we recognize that authority is illegitimate in the same way that the authority that decided the political decisions in that heavy week in August of 1968 was illegitimate, did not represent the will and the desire of the people. So we cannot respect an authority that we regard as illegitimate. We can only offer resistance to such illegitimate authority." Abby makes multiple comments about Judge Hoffman being a Nazi. He says, "You're a disgrace to the Jews. You would have served Hitler better, dig it." when the judge constantly, for some reason, name drops architect Mies van der Rohe, who he said he knew personally. Hoffman said Mies van der Rohe was a kraut too. Judge Hoffman tells him to be respectful, and he says, "Respectful? My six-year-old daughter yesterday sent me a note. She said perhaps when the judge changes his glasses, he doesn't have a pair that enables him to see what the defendants are all about. The use of the word respect is quite different to me. I called this place a neon oven in a stainless steel cuckoo nest designed by your friend Mies van der Rohe. I might add, he died right after he built this. It kind of killed him. Building a building in which he had to put men away in prison and perhaps into death houses." So what do the other defendants think of these stunts from Hoffman and Rubin? Well, Tom Hayden said, "They believe little mattered beyond being on television. If you dressed appropriately, if you had long hair, that image would reach your base. Your image would offend the right people and attract the right people." Abby says one time, "If you don't like the news, why not go out and make your own?" Hayden is going to describe Jerry and Abby as partners, but also the two were rivals for attention. But Hayden is going to have respect for Hoffman and says Abby's the greatest performance artist that he's ever seen. He said they wanted to project this yippie message out into the world of a generational revolt that was anti-racist and anti-war. Movement photographer David Fenton once said, the yippies were one of the first great myths of the television era. It was Abby and three guys. That's it. He credits Abby's genius for using TV to spread their message and make Nixon think that there were millions of card-carrying yippies, but it really was a small movement with a message now that is being broadcast all across the country and world. And one of the amazing things that Abby does is he goes to rallies at night throughout the trial, partially to raise money for their defense, and he would always ask crowds what they were going to do TDA, the day after their convictions. It was a call to take to the streets. And the FBI and others are constantly tailing the whole group throughout the trial, and they have been for years, as part of a broader strategy from the FBI in the 1960s to target these protest leaders, like they target Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and all these left-wing leaders that they're in really problematic ways observing and very often trying to disrupt in illegal ways. Most of the things that you just heard about were from Abby just watching and commenting on what's happening during the trial. Let's do a deep dive into his testimony on the actual stand, because it's beautiful. Let's start first with a back and forth between he and his own lawyer, Leonard Weinglass. "Will you please identify yourself for the record?" "My name is Abby. I am an orphan of America." "Where do you reside?" "I live in Woodstock Nation." "Will you tell the court and jury where it is?" "Yes. As a nation of alienated young people, we carry it around with us as a state of mind in the same way as the Sioux Indians carried the Sioux Nation around with them. It is a nation dedicated to cooperation versus competition, to the idea that people should have better means of exchange than property or money, that there should be some other basis for human interaction. It is a nation dedicated to
just where it is, that is all.
It is in my mind, in the minds of my brothers and sisters. It does not consist of property or material, but rather of ideas and certain values. We believe in a society—
"No, we want the place of residence, if he has one. Place of doing business, if you have a business. Nothing about philosophy or India, sir. Just where you live, if you have a place to live. Now, you said Woodstock. In what state is Woodstock?"
"It is in the state of mind, in the mind of myself and my brothers and sisters. It is a conspiracy. Presently, the nation is held captive in the penitentiaries of the institutions of a decaying system." "Can you tell the court and jury your present age?" "My age is 33. I am a child of the 60s.
"When were you born?"
"Psychologically, 1960.
"Objection. If the court please, I move to strike the answer."
"So between the date of your birth, November 30th, 1936, and May 1st, 1960, what, if anything, occurred in your life?"
"Nothing. I believe it is called an American education."
As he's being cross-examined by Richard Schultz one time, he's asked if he was determined to smash the system by using any means at his disposal.
"Are you asking if I had those thoughts, or if I wrote that I had those thoughts? There's a difference."
"It's a convenient difference, isn't it, Mr. Hoffman?"
"I don't know what you mean. I've never been on trial for my thoughts before."
This is my favorite question he gets asked on cross-examination from Schultz. "Did you symbolically urinate on the Pentagon, Mr. Hoffman?"
"I didn't get that close. Pee on the walls of the Pentagon? You're getting to be out of sight, actually. You think there's a law against it?"
"Are you done, Mr. Hoffman?"
"I'm done when you are."
"Did you ever state that a sense of integration possesses you and comes from pissing on the Pentagon?"
"I said, from combining political attitudes with biological necessity, there's a sense of integration, yes."
"You had a good time at the Pentagon, didn't you, Mr. Hoffman?"
"Yes, I did. I'm having a good time now, too. I feel that biological necessity now. Could I be excused for a slight recess?"
"Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we will take a brief recess."
Later on, Schultz asks Abby about a nude-in happening at the Festival for Life. A nude-in? I don't believe I would use that phrase, no. I don't think it's very poetic, frankly. I might have told him that 10,000 people were going to walk naked on the waters of Lake Michigan, something like that. I object to this because Mr. Schultz is acting like a dirty old man.
Do you object?
I am just remarking, Your Honor, that a young man can be a dirty old man. You know, if we try to focus in on the actual content of the trial here, they're trying to show that they incited this riot, right? And at one point in time, Abby's own lawyers are going to ask him about using the phrase fight and die here when talking to people at the protest. And they ask him, what context were you using these words? And Abby said, it's a metaphor. That means that we felt strongly about our right to assemble in the park and that people should be willing to take risks for it. It doesn't spell it out because people were capable of fighting in their own way and making their own decisions, and we never would tell anyone specifically that they should fight, fist fight. But frankly, the facts of the case don't really matter because this really is a political trial and the outcome was determined before it ever started. So when sentencing comes, all of them are going to be acquitted on the conspiracy charges but still somehow get fined $5,000 each for it. And Abby and four others are going to get convicted of the crossing state lines with the intent to riot piece of this. So they couldn't prove that it was a conspiracy, but they're still going to charge them and get the max 5-year sentence. By the end of the trial, the defense team had racked up 159 counts of contempt. Abby's going to wind up getting an additional 8 months. The biggest amount of time for contempt was for their attorney, Kunstler, who gets 4 years. The judge is going to order that they have their long hair shaved immediately after sentencing, and then the sheriff held Abby's hair up as a trophy at the press conference. Defendant Dave Dellinger at the sentencing said, whatever happens to us, however unjustified, will be slight compared to what has happened already to the Vietnamese people, to the black people in this country, to the criminals with whom we are now spending our days in the Cook County Jail. Let's let Abby have the final word at the trial, where we're going to hear his final thoughts for the court at sentencing, and he's going to address how the prosecution has tried to paint him as un-American. I know these guys on the wall. I know them better than you, I feel. I know Adams. I know all the Adams. They grew up 20 miles from my home in Massachusetts. I played with Sam Adams on the Concord Bridge. I was there when Paul Revere rode right up on his motorcycle and said, "The pigs are coming! The pigs are coming!" right into Lexington. I was there. I know the Adams. Sam Adams was an evil man. Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson called for a revolution every 10 years. Thomas Jefferson had an agrarian reform program that made Mao Zedong look like a liberal. I know Thomas Jefferson. Hamilton? Well, I didn't dig the Federalists. Maybe he deserved to have his brains blown out. Washington? Washington grew pot. He called it hemp. It was called hemp then. He probably was a pothead. Abraham Lincoln? There's another one. In 1861, Abraham Lincoln, in his inaugural address, said, and I quote, "When the people shall grow weary of their constitutional right to amend the government, they shall exert their revolutionary right to dismember and overthrow that government." If Lincoln had given that speech in Lincoln Park, he'd be on trial right here in this courtroom, because that is an insightful speech. That is a speech intended to create a riot. His final words in court were, "I will see you in Florida, Julie." So, unsurprisingly, they're going to win their appeal for this case in November 1972. The conviction is overturned. Judge Hoffman's going to be criticizing the ruling for failure to fulfill the standards of our system of justice. And the main reason for overturning was that Judge Hoffman refused to let the defense attorneys do things like screen jurors for racial and cultural bias. Obviously, he demonstrated a lot of bias throughout the trial in the way that he treated the defendants. And also, the FBI was bugging their offices throughout the whole time, and it was just a disaster. So all contempt charges are overturned as well, and so no one is actually held responsible for this, but the trial was still a mockery, and some people still did prison time before they had this overturned. Let's hear a little bit about what Abby's life is like after the trial. In 1971, he makes an even bigger name for himself on a national stage by writing Steal This Book, A Handbook for Survival in Warfare. There's going to be more than 24 New York publishers who are going to reject this manuscript, but he winds up getting $15,000 from friends. He creates his own group called Pirate Editions to help put it out, and works with this group called Grove Press, who admitted that we chain the books to the counter. In other words, buy the book, don't steal it. The book called Steal This Book. No newspapers would review it. In Ohio, stores would wrap the book in a paper with the state shoplifting law on it. And Canada is going to seize copies at the border. The FBI calls the book a manual for revolutionary extremists foisted on the reading public by Grove Press. So the book has three sections, one on getting food and clothing for free, another one on building a protest movement, and then finally, healthcare, food, resources for people in major cities. Abby says in the book, ripping off is an act of revolutionary love. So the broader commentary is that no crime committed by an individual liberator could ever match or compare to the broader crimes of big corporations. He says, saying that shoplifting accounts for high prices is like saying that people using colored toilet paper are responsible for this ecological mess. All our ripoffs together don't equal one price-fixing scheme by General Electric. He says shoplifted food tastes better, and it's going to sell beyond 100,000 copies in 4 months. Proceeds actually went to radio station broadcasting in New York to GIs in Southeast Asia. And Hoffman amusingly says, it's embarrassing when you try to overthrow the government and you wind up on the bestsellers list. Abby never stops getting in trouble with the law. From 1974 to 1980, he's going to go underground because he's avoiding cocaine charges because he done sold $36,000 of coke to an undercover New York Police Department officer. He's going to jump bail. He's going to actually report his own disappearance to the police. As he's in hiding, he's going to have plastic surgery to try to change his appearance. And this is when he has a son with his second wife, Anita. They're going to name their son America with a lowercase a. He's going to travel around Europe as a food reviewer. And he's going to reappear in 1980 in upstate New York as Barry Freed. And he makes this appearance on national TV in this Barbara Walters interview that he pre-records. And then the day after the interview, he surrenders. He pleads guilty, assuming the passions had dwindled from the 1960s, so he'd have a more lenient sentence, and he only has to serve 1 year in prison. Later on in life, he's going to do a few things like write an autobiography titled Soon to Be a Major Motion Picture. He can never stop telling jokes. But in 1980, he's going to get diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He's going to spend his later life lecturing at universities, kind of 50 a year. He's going to make his living primarily through this. He describes his profession as a community organizer during this time. He's going to get arrested at an anti-CIA protest in Massachusetts with Amy Carter, Jimmy Carter's daughter. So he never stops fighting for causes that he believes in till the end. For all the joy and strength and power that Abby brought into this world, he has a very sad end to his story. On April 12, 1989, he's found dead in his New Hope, Pennsylvania apartment with 150 phenobarbital tablets and alcohol in his stomach, and his death is ruled a suicide. At his funeral, Jerry Rubin said, "He was a very rare person who could not be replaced. He combined humor and commitment and dedication, and his whole life stood for something." Timothy Leary said, "He was an American legend. He was up there in the Hall of Fame with Rebel Huck Finn, Rowdy Babe Ruth, Crazy Lenny Bruce. He was a hustler, a base stealer, a wild free spirit, and a gambler." And the rabbi at his funeral held in his childhood synagogue in Worcester said, "Abby's public life had been lived in the Jewish prophetic tradition, which is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable." As a historian, I think that when we reflect on Abby's legacy, it's important for us to recognize that he should be taken seriously for all the ridiculousness that he brought to the table. He was standing up in the face of oppression with the Vietnam War, with racism, with the greed of capitalism in this era, and he's going to fight against those things in ways that help spread that message to a wider audience than many traditional activists were able to do. Thank you so much for listening today. I want to recommend a couple different things to you. First would be the Trial of the Chicago 7 on Netflix. If you haven't seen that Aaron Sorkin movie, it's really freaking good. And then a book that I'd recommend to you is by Clara Bingham, and it's called Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. It was a really cool reference source for me because it's all an oral history of this element of the 1960s. If you like the show, there's a link in the episode notes to buy me a cup of coffee, put a little tip in the tip jar, fund some new sound equipment for the studio. I always appreciate, if you're not willing to do that, to rate and subscribe on whatever podcast service you use. You can follow us at Daring Dissent on Instagram. And let's not forget that ultimately, history is a practice in empathy. As always, let's have the final word be given to our subject for today, Abby Hoffman. There's no incongruity in conducting serious business and having fun.